smells like chlorine.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Is this where you chlorinate all along the line?
If I could get each of you to sign in on this form, you don't have to get real detailed, but just your name and...
What's the date today?
Today is the 28th.
I'm wondering if you can just say
that was on the laptop they had. So that wasn't...
So here's a really good math.
Yes, I am.
I'm David
John. How do you do? I'll introduce myself and my compadre. Nice
is
chilly day for this.
Compadres 1 and 2 and 3.
Just
do you normally work here? Is this your...
I split my time between here and the city, and I'll explain that too. As soon as everybody's...
I'm James Deal.
Dave McConaughey.
Dave McConaughey.
I'm John Adams. Stokes.
John Chokes?
Stokes.
Stokes.
I didn't catch up.
Audrey Adams.
Audrey.
So your name is Stokes.
Mm-hmm.
What's your first name?
John.
John Stokes.
Mm-hmm.
I got a brother-in-law named Stokes.
And what's your name?
Dave McConaughey.
I have a brother-in-law named Stokes.
Really?
Lloyd, do you know him?
No,
not related. Yeah.
Maybe somewhere back.
He's from Montana. Oh,
okay. Originally hailed from the Midwest, among the dirty relatives.
What is a clear well?
It's basically a reservoir that also functions for chlorine contact.
So it's a way of mixing it, dispersing it?
Well, it's already mixed when it goes in, but you have to have time.
For it to do its job?
To do disinfection. So.
Yeah.
It's big, but basically it's a big tank, right?
So is that picture there, that dam, is that on the other end?
No, that's up in the mountains. Oh. And I'll explain all that, too. You're going to get it top to bottom today.
Yay, I'm so excited. That's kinky.
I'm David John. Nice to meet you. I'm John Stokes.
Yeah. Dave. Yeah, my name's Ed.
Hi, Ed.
Okay, I think we're good enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so welcome to the Everett Water Treatment Plant. My name is Mark Weeks. And I, my official title is Drinking Water Process Analyst, but what that really means is I coordinate the regulatory program compliance for both here and down in Everett's distribution system. This is John Stokes. He's one of the operators here at the plant. And you met Dave McConaughey. He's actually operating today, so he's in what we call the hot seat.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to start today with kind of an overview of both our watershed and then kind of a walkthrough of the treatment process, and then we'll actually walk through the plant and you can look at stuff. Just a couple comments about safety. This is an industrial site. So when we walk through areas, it's best not to stray too far either side of where we're going.
Okay.
And please don't touch any of the equipment because some things do present a hazard. We do have hazardous materials stored here on site, obviously, so we'll try to direct you when we are around those parts of the plant. So, first thing to talk about is our source water, which in Everett's case, Everett has perfected water rights from the Upper Salton River Basin. And so this map is kind of a big picture map of the whole thing from source all the way down to the distribution. Fundamentally, our watershed is the mountainous areas around Spada Reservoir, which is 8 miles east of us here. It sits in the foothills or the front range of the Cascades. It's a very wet area. It's where the clouds converge after they wrap around the Olympics and pass by Seattle and the rest
it's
of Puget
Sound.
Convergent
zone.
So you're looking at about, on average, 165 inches of rain every year. The city originally perfected water rights, just diverting water directly out of the Salton River. The original diversion was a rock and log dam with a wooden pipeline. Today, what we have is basically a 50 billion gallon reservoir behind Kulmbach Dam. It's part of a joint project between Snohomish PUD and the City of Everett. So we store water both for water supply and for power generation. And they have a project up there called the Henry Jackson Hydroelectric Project. And so water, once it's stored here in Spada from the runoff in the hills, comes through a tunnel and a pipeline down to a powerhouse. You pass the substation down there for the powerhouse on your way in. It's right down below there on the river. And then there's a second pipe that carries water up from the powerhouse to the shores of Lake Chaplain. And Lake Chaplain is the city's original storage reservoir. In the old days, they actually diverted water through a tunnel into the lake. We no longer use that system except under emergency conditions. And now the water comes through the powerhouse, up the pipeline past the plant, and then dumps both into Lake Chaplain and runs backwards up the old system and over into the river. And so they supply fish flow via the old diversion system, only in reverse. And fundamentally, the PUD is responsible for maintaining Chaplain within a fairly narrow range. And they both do fish flow and water supply via that system. This powerhouse supplies roughly about 5 to 10% of the county's power, I believe. And so we have kind of an operating agreement with them relative to all of this stuff. They basically own these facilities, and the city owns the water treatment facilities.
So you're city employees?
Yes. The watershed around Lake Chaplain, which is a smaller reservoir, it's about 4.5 billion gallons or 4 to 6. When it's full, this watershed is basically closed to public access. It's wholly owned by the city of Everett. It's actually part of the city of Everett. This area here, the land ownership is a little bit different, and it's mainly owned by the state of Washington. DNR operates as forest land. And there are some U.S. Forest Service land and a few very small parcels of private. But because of the hydro project, we have to allow certain recreational activities, but they're very restricted. No swimming, no boating except in rigid boats, no floatable, inflatable stuff. Fishing is restricted to non-bait fishing lures only. We have full-time watershed patrol that covers both these areas. They're city employees. So we're watching what goes on at all times. And the city's been involved in this Salt River thing since 1917. That was the original diversion. They made the initial construction of the original Kulmbach Dam in 1965, and in between 17 and 65, the city built in 1929 this diversion system into Chaplain and the original first northern pipeline, of which there are now three. In the old days, of course, it was just river water straight into the lake, and then out of the lake, a little chlorine off the town.
Do all three pipelines contain the fluoride?
Yes. Well, there's actually four pipelines, and I'll get to that. So we have the water treatment plant here at the south end of Lake Chaplain, which is where we are now. After we treat the water, we route water, finished treated water, to town two routes. The southern route, which is the route of the original old 1917 wood line, is we call it the number five line, but it's more of a southerly route. It's a little bit longer, about 29 miles. Terminates in the middle of Everett, up off of Evergreen Way at about 60th. From there, there's a pumping system all the way to Alderwood, by Linwood, Alderwood Manor. The other route is the northern route, and there are actually, originally, were two tunnels through the hill over there. Currently, one tunnel carries finished water to two of those three pipelines you see by the trestle. You can see them exposed out here by the river. And the other line carried industrial water, which is direct diversion out of Lake Chaplain, with a small amount of chlorine in it to the Kimberly-Clark Mill, which is now shut down, or about to shut completely down. By the 1st of March, we'll no longer be supplying industrial water by this green so-called number four line.
So you could put chlorinated water in this line?
In the old days, you could. Yeah.
Is this potable?
Yes. Everything that's in blue is potable water coming out of the treatment plant. The green is
finished water.
Yeah, we call it finished water or treated water, however you want to say it. Fully treated water, I guess, is another way to say it.
Has this been treated with flocculant to clean it out?
Yes, and we'll get into the treatment
process. So everything except the fluoride?
Well, it carries everything.
Including
how much soda ash?
The industrial line only carries raw water, but it's chlorinated raw water from Lake Chaplain. And it has a separate diversion out of the lake. This other line here you see is water that's pumped from here at the treatment plant up to this other tunnel, and it's isolated from the lake, but carries treated water all the way to town.
All three of these carry treated water?
Two carry treated, one carries industrial.
And where does the industrial water go?
It terminates at a reservoir up on the hill directly above where the mill is.
Oh, so both of these lines can supply the mill?
Theoretically.
Because it seems like this pipeline goes back up this way.
The original system back prior to filtration, which was installed in 1982, was basically lake water with chlorine in it. So chlorine was the only treatment. Mm-hmm. And the entire system was intertied. So it has a tremendous amount of redundancy. It's why the two parallel tunnels, separate intakes. We don't have redundancy in the southern corridor, but we do north.
And why redundancy?
Well, it was a capacity issue. Most of the mills were in this part of Everett. You know, Everett originally had 9 major paper mills operating all at the same time. Peak flow during that time period was 175 million gallons a day. Peak flow now, we've peaked at, about 115 of treated water. But it used to be there was a tremendous demand from the mills, and then as the mills began to go away,
the people moved in.
They started suburban development, particularly in Southwest County, and of course Alderwood's been a partner in this deal for a while. And I think the original connection was in 1933, so not long after the construction of this second pipeline.
You have to treat and provide 115 million.
Well, yeah, we have a kind of a seasonal flow picture. So the average flow of this plant is normally about 50 million gallons a day of treated water, and during the operation of the mill, an additional 30 million was diverted from Chaplin.
Excuse me, you have to provide about 50 million gallons of fresh water
and that's
per day.
9 months of the year, that's roughly our flow. But when we get a summer, flows typically would double. So people are watering
their
lawns.
Ready to do 100.
Right. So you have to have the capacity for your peak demand.
So where's your service area on here?
So this is actually a better map for that. So here's Spada. Here's the treatment plant. Here's Lake Chaplin. Then you have the two pipelines. Here's the southern five-line route and the northern route. Everett comprises about one-fifth of our retail service area, so roughly a little over 100,000 people. And the bulk of the rest of the water goes all over the place. So we start with the city of Sultan as our first customer down the road here a ways on the southern route, and then it's a series of water districts all the way in. It includes all of the southwest corner of the county. There are various districts. And then north, we include
like
Mary's.
Mill Creek and Bothell?
Mill Creek is part of the Alderwood system.
And Alderwood is on your system.
So Alderwood Water and Wastewater District is this area right in here, the orange. And so they include Briar, they include Mill Creek, and then a number of unincorporated areas all the way out to the edge of Cross Valley Water District in Bothell, as well as the city of Bothell. And then on the backside of Alderwood, they're wheeling water back to Linwood, Edmonds, and Malik Terrace.
So what about Olympic View and Woodway?
I don't know about Olympic View.
Do they get theirs from Seattle?
I don't believe so. I think years ago when Seattle had their man-made shortage, they converted them over, but I couldn't tell you for sure. So and then north.
Are there any independent water districts in here that have their own water?
Not that I know of. Okay. There may be some small well systems. I have no idea how many of
them. Well, half of Snohomish is fluoridated. Which half is it?
You'd have to ask them.
Okay.
Roughly 60% of their supply comes from us, and the other 40 from their Pilchuck River treatment plant.
So your service area is basically the south end of that would be roughly city of Bothell.
Well, and then we go north, so we have Pewee, Lake Stevens, we have Marysville, which is about 60% of their supply. We're about to expand. Two layups are building a pipeline. It'll take us all the way to the end of the Two Layup Reservation. Now, when I say service area, I mean the service area of this plant.
Right.
I distinguish it as wholesale and retail. So Everett is our retail service area. We direct serve individual customers there. These other large districts, we sell them bulk water off the transmission lines, and they're responsible for operation, maintenance, and compliance.
And billing and all that stuff.
Right. They do. They're their own. We don't own any of their facilities beyond the meter.
But even in summer, 100 million gallons will supply all of this that you're talking about.
You're looking at a current population, I think estimates are roughly 550,000 people out of this plant.
But then 100 million gallons a day, even in summer, would provide all of what you're talking
so
about.
So far, yeah.
Okay.
And Everett currently
owns a lot of spare water up there.
They own water rights to a maximum of 242 million a day. They have all but one.
They have the right to take that much water?
Yes. It's perfected all but the last increment.
Could you handle that through here, or would you have to have modifications?
The plant is currently, and we might as well get into the plant next.
But wait, this area here is what you're supplying water to.
That's the whole
the
county.
Red line is actually would be considered
That's the county.
Yeah.
Well, that's the county.
Well, roughly, but
county line here.
Future potential water service might include this whole area. And right. There's been all kinds of crazy political discussions about who wheels water where and for how long and when do they intertie the whole mess.
Why is so much of that map blue right there? Why is all that blue?
I don't understand.
Like that.
Okay. Well, there's a legend here.
You mean the different colors?
Yeah, because over there, blue means water.
Well, this is water, but this is somewhat faded. So the colors have not, they're becoming less distinct, not more distinct. But each one of these is a water district.
Can you? Can I request a copy of this by email from you?
I believe in the stuff we're going to send you, this map is in there.
Okay. So you're making progress on that stuff?
We're getting close.
Oh, thank you.
Can you look at an overall map here? We get water from Seattle. I live on Mercer Island.
Mm-hmm.
Where does Seattle get its water?
Their northern source right here. This is the Tolt system.
Oh, there.
So the Tolt treatment plant's right down here.
I see.
Cedar River, the Chester Morse watershed, is further south, south of Interstate 90.
So this whole thing is sort of north of where?
Yes, Snohomish County is the northern county from King.
Well, so like Lake Young's, is that considered just a holding area? Is it kind of like where you
Seattle has kind of an odd, it's not a typical treatment scheme. So water comes out of Chester Morse, gets released from the Chester Morse Dam down to a diversion dam, kind of like this thing. This is our old diversion dam from 1929. Mm-hmm. And then they have a screening system there and big bar screens to keep the big pieces out. And then that water gets treated with, I believe, fluoride and chlorine there, soda ash for pH. Then it goes into Lake Young's. And Lake Young's is actually a natural lake. But following all of those treatments and storage in Lake Young's, they have a UV and ozone disinfection plant. So they withdraw the water out of Lake Young's and then they re-disinfect it for those, and then they add another dose of chlorine since you would have lost it all in an open sunlight.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay.
And so that system is another strategy for dealing with microbial contaminants. And so disinfection is all about killing the bugs.
And how is your strategy different?
Well, we took a slightly different approach. So Everett had difficulty meeting the turbidity limits. Chester Morse is a relatively pristine source. Seattle owns over 90% of land and watershed. It's completely closed to access. They have controlled forestry there, but not much else. So typically, that's a really big reservoir, and so what that means is runoff tends to settle its turbidity in the reservoir, which, you know, Spada does the same thing as it does Chaplin, but we couldn't meet in the winter. This original diversion system where you release water out of here, diverted into Lake Chaplin, this is a very dirty runoff in the winter.
Clouded, you mean?
Yeah, it's got a lot of particles.
A lot of particles.
So particles interfere with disinfection, and they also are masking particles that are, you know, real pathogens. So we're talking bacteria, viruses, and protozoa typically. And so we weren't able to meet those requirements for below a certain turbidity. In the old days, it was 5 units of turbidity or less. And so fortunately for Everett, they had a very powerful senator, Scoop Jackson, who lived in Everett, and he teamed up when the PUD decided to build the second phase of this project, which they raised Kalmbach Dam about 90 feet. They increased the volume of Spada Reservoir by fivefold, so from 11 billion gallons up to 50. And part of the deal was, though, is that while they're doing all this project and you inundate all this land with water, you don't really know what the water quality impacts are going to be. And so they approached the PUD and said, look, we can get some federal money via our senator. If Everett chips in another big chunk, if you guys are willing to pay for a treatment plant, then we won't make you treat the river water for X number of years until we know this thing settles out and calms down. Because usually the initial few years of a new reservoir when you get these big fluctuations and you've inundated all this organic material and you start to grow stuff, you can have all kinds of changes in inorganic constituent chemistry when you bury it in 200 feet of water, and it's all got to come to some sort of equilibration at some point. So PUD chipped in, the city chipped in their chunk, and then they got a federal grant. And so for $30 million, they built this plant. So this plant is what's known as a direct filtration plant. So when you talk about microbial contaminants, you can have what we call a multiple barrier system. So watershed protection is one barrier. You may try to maintain high quality water at the source. With filtration, you're physically removing particles as opposed to killing things with chemicals. And generally, filtration is done in combination with a disinfection, but at a lesser intensity, so less chemicals. In our case, it's chlorine. So this is a schematic of the plant process. Lake Chaplin here, which is right above us. Water can come into the plant by two routes. We have the original 1965 gravity flow system, which originally had screens in it, similar to what Seattle's Lake Young's Landsberg system has. Those are no longer in there. Or we have a line that comes over the dam, and it's just basically a big siphon. So two routes for raw water to come out of Lake Chaplin.
You see a huge 4-foot pipe right out here. Which one is that?
The big one over the dam is a 72-inch diameter.
That's what we're looking
siphon
at.
Line, yes. It's really big. Yes.
So is this to scale, or is it oriented north and south, or is this more of a...
No, this is schematic.
Schematic diagram.
It's oriented basically in the general layout of the site, but it's not at all to scale.
So but the water comes in from where, over yonder?
Right behind us over here.
Oh.
Basically, we're looking... this is oriented kind of a north-south, north to the left, south to the right. So kind of an odd relative to site. We're perpendicular the way it's actually laid out. But
so you've got gravity flow coming in.
But typically we use the gravity line. Raw water comes in through into the gravity structure. Right here we add a dose of pre-disinfectant chlorine. It serves two purposes. One is to oxidize iron and manganese, which otherwise will oxidize later and foul the system. When iron and manganese oxidize, they come out as a nasty-looking dark brown or super fine particle. So we oxidize it and precipitate it here. We also are doing the first step of a
disinfection. What do you oxidize it with?
Chlorine.
Oh, chlorine. Do you bubble the chlorine in?
No, it's pumped in as a solution.
Solution.
And I'll get to the type of chlorine that we're currently using, but in this case it's bleach, essentially.
Bleach.
Or super strength, 12.5%.
Nasty stuff.
It's twice the strength you buy at the store.
What's the pH on that?
Of the bleach?
Of the hypochlorite.
It's about 12.
Are you guys under medical checks? Because I smell chlorine in the air here. Don't you smell it?
Oh, yeah.
Are you getting special medical checks every year about
no.
anything to do with chlorine affecting you or the staff here?
Doesn't seem to.
If I worked here, I'd wear a mask.
Yeah, levels aren't high enough. You can't check it with a detector.
Oh,
we can smell it, but you can't find it with a GPS.
Smells like a swimming pool.
We've used like when you go into enclosed areas, like if you were to work in a storage tank, obviously you'd have different issues.
Yeah.
But we've used it in enclosed reservoirs downtown. Our detector it's a lot stronger there than it's here. It doesn't set anything off. We attempted to use respirators, and they just get in the way. And what we discovered is we're not logging any values that are of any significance. At any rate, so raw water comes in, gets a shot of chlorine, the pre-disinfection step. Right past the inlet structure, buried in the ground, are some very large pipes, and this is where we inject two chemical coagulants. So the first one is alum or aluminum sulfate. And a coagulant basically is aimed at taking these finely suspended particles. A lot of the turbidity that comes out of the system is in the form of colloids. And colloids, by definition, will never settle. They're too small and light relative to gravity, and so they never really settle out of the water. And then they have a couple of issues with them. One is that all colloids typically have a surface charge that's negative. They repel each other. So they never want to bundle up and clump together. And they'll stay in solution or suspension in your water forever. And, of course, suspended with them are the guys we're after, which are the pathogens.
So it's magnesium and iron and pathogens that you want to precipitate.
Right. And in the case of the pathogens, we're really aimed at killing them with chlorine. But when we add alum, what we're doing is we're changing that surface charge. Alum's a very positive nucleus to it. So what the end result of that is that all these little particles bundle up into what we call flock. So you get a big bundle of little particles into a big one. And then subsequent to the alum, we add a second treatment coagulant, which is a polymer. And the polymer is designed to... augment the element to further enhance this particle formation.
I have a quick question. What's the fluoride level in this water?
non-detectable, less than 0.2 milligrams per liter. This is a super soft surface water.
Because the aluminum might take a fluoride out. I was just wondering.
Yeah, it will. Yeah. Big time.
So the water on the other side of the flocculation being added must be essentially zero.
Well,
it's already low.
Well, it's here. Non-detectable already. I didn't really talk much about water quality beyond turbidity here, but this is a what we call a very soft, very low mineral content water. It's basically rain collected in a reservoir. It has a relatively low pH, generally 7 or less. Super soft is another way to say it.
Have you ever actually measured the fluoride level in raw surface rainwater like this?
Oh, yeah. With our instrumentation, we can't measure it. It's below the detection
level. What is the detection level?
The instrument we're using is good down to about 0.01 milligrams per liter.
And it's less than that?
0.01.
Yeah.
So that would be true of snowmelt water in general?
Yes.
How does the 165 inches of rain a year at Spada compare to what falls here in the King County?
Well, to give an example, Everett, it's about 38 inches a year.
Yeah.
Here at the treatment plant, you're roughly looking at 85. As you move towards the foothills, you have orographic lifting as the clouds come in. As they lift, they cool and they rain.
What's the altitude of Spada Reservoir?
So we're looking at a full pool elevation of about 14 or 50 feet above sea level. About the lowest they've ever been is 1385. PUD draws this reservoir down every year in anticipation of the fall. I call it the monsoon. Because it's not unusual up here in November, if we get the typical, what I call a November gully washer, to have rainfalls that range anywhere from 4 to 12 inches a day up there.
Wow.
So it's a massive runoff really fast.
What's the level down here at
And you're at about
Chaplin.
Chaplin is operated between 645 and 650 above sea level. So here at this site, we're obviously about 30 feet lower than that.
So you have a huge head of hydro.
They do. Maximum generating capacity here, if you dumped it all straight to the river, is about 112 megawatts. That's both Pelton's online. They have two types of turbines, high flow and low flow turbines. But because of the way they have to operate the project, you lose about 16 megawatts because you got to run water uphill through this pipeline and back over into the river for fish.
Wow.
So when they operate that way, they can't run the full 112. They run 96.
Why not just put the water back in here?
Because they're required to provide fish flow here.
And the flow here is diminished?
Yes.
Otherwise, it would be diminished?
Because you've got it all dammed up here.
So
you're bypassing the upper reach of the reservoir.
Is this Sultan River lower than its natural flow level?
Yes.
Oh, really?
This segment. Basically, when they put this dam in 1929, really it started in 17, but this one really killed it as far as fish. Also, about this far down is a cliff in the river. No fish ever got up here. It's a big, over 30 feet high. You have to rappel off it when you lower the fish biologists in to look at it. It's an impassable barrier. But their PUD is going to be under the new FERC license, which they just recently completed. They'll be building a fish ladder over the dam to enhance fishery in this lower segment of the upper reach. And the city, part of the reason we're selling water to the Tulalips is they said, hey, you guys took away fish since 1917, and you owe us $36 million. And the deal is we give them $5 million for the pipeline construction, and we give them a contract similar to Alderwood's for in perpetuity. And they're going to build a 36 to 40-inch pipeline all the way to North County. So they're looking to the future for development on the reservation, obviously.
Right.
So that's the agreement that's been worked out. But there will be further fisheries enhancements here. The new FERC license includes PUD constructing intakes higher up in the reservoir so they can supply warmer water to this reach of the river. Because the stuff that comes out the bottom of the dam is, down deep and it's cold, even in the summer. And it basically produces low productivity in the river. All the insects and algae and the whole ecosystem is impacted by the fact that you're releasing this. It's about a 20 cubic feet per second flow. That's the base flow through this reach currently. But that'll be changed. And of course, they release much higher flows depending on season. And they have a whole curve they have to follow in their permit. You know, there's so many hundreds of cubic feet per second have to be released if fish flows, and it's complicated. It's a fairly complex operation for the PUD to try and balance all of these flows. They're trying to keep Lake Chaplin in a certain range. They're trying to supply a certain minimum flow over the old dam to the river and also meet any other flow requirements.
It was Chaplin a lake before the dam?
There was a natural lake here, yes.
Smaller?
Much
lower?
Located in this part of the... There was a church camp here, although it's not named for the church chaplain, apparently, but...
So are you what they call a hydrologist or hydrologist, or what is your professional?
I am certified, as is John, as a water treatment plant operator and a water distribution manager by the state. My original line of study was wildlife biology, but President Reagan had pretty much gutted any and all state and federal programs relative to wildlife when I graduated from college, so I became a climbing bum. And in my travels as a climbing bum, I met a guy who actually ended up was our superintendent here, and he encouraged me to start looking for water jobs, and it so happened that Everett had two operators quit, and so I applied and was hired back in 1987 as an operator. But I've been focused on regulations and water quality since 92, and I spent 10 years down the distribution system from 97 to 2007. Dealing with distribution issues relative to regulation. Obviously, the EPA hasn't stopped writing new drinking water regulations. And
you must be a two-man at other jobs.
Well, I've never moved. I've been here 24 years.
I mean, I bet you could.
I'm not an engineer is probably the way to say it. I call myself a false chemist because most of the people I work with are chemists. But... most of the guys here, the operators, all come from technical backgrounds of one sort or another. Most of them have 2 or 4 year degrees in some science. Some have more than that.
So outside of the plant itself, the step towards clean water begins here, right?
This is actually a very important aspect of our water supply. The way I put it is there's no substitute for a great source. So, you know, there's a picture of what you really were talking about. That is the Salton Basin. This is Kulmbach Dam right here. This is the intake to the PUD's power system right there. This is the overflow to the reservoir. But this is Spada Reservoir. It has three major tributaries, Williamson Creek, the North Fork, and the South Fork of the Salton River. You can see the DNR has had its way with it. Mm-hmm. Those help build and maintain schools. 100-acre cuts started back in the 70s and completed in the mid-80s for the main part.
DNR?
Right. Department of Natural Resources for the state of Washington. Most of their forest program is designed where the revenues go to the school programs for the state.
So you say this lake has limited access but to the public?
There are recreational sites. There's one here at the dam. There's a boat launch right about here and another one right about here. The remainder of the South Shore Road has now been put to bed, this is the old North Shore Road, and it's been put to bed for over a decade. They took the culverts out. They restored the natural drainage lines. The DNR and the Forest Service, once they've gone in and done their logging thing, they don't see the sense in maintaining roads that they won't use for another 70 years. This is a relatively high elevation, slow growth forest.
So this is the road in, though, this one right here?
This is the road in, right. See it here. This is Olney Pass. Come in here, and then the road splits.
Well, if you want to go hiking or fishing in there, do you have to go through the gate and say who you are, or get a permit in advance?
They have a voluntary self-registration at the Olney Pass. There are some trails. There are trails to Boulder Lake on one side of this, and then up to the Grider Lakes.
I bet that's a beautiful place.
It's a bit of a hike these days because you've got to walk an old abandoned road now.
Now, so instead of taking the road we came, do they turn it Reiner's Road?
You could go that way, but you'd basically go on Highway 2 to the Salton Basin Road.
Oh.
And you drive, this is basically the end of the Salton Basin Road is here.
So there's another way up there.
Yes. You know where the last light in Salton is? It's right there.
Take
you
go
past where the old chainsaw place used to be, kind of. Anyway, right there, they built a new light. Salton's been doing some changes of their own. But anyway, right there you turn left, and that is the Salton Basin Road.
Why is Spada Lake open to public use, whereas the King County lakes are completely closed?
Well, we don't own the land. It's public land, and it has a prior historic use. So when you go to build a hydro project and a water storage facility, you still have to meet or at least the equivalent of the prior use. So in that case, because it was Department of Natural Resources, state land, and U.S. Forest Service, that included recreational access. So you can't take it away. However, we do have limits on it. They've all made agreement with Everett is relative to the sorts of activities. So you're not swimming in it. You're not fishing with live bait. You're not camping overnight. None of those activities are allowed. And it has, you know, all kinds of warnings and signs. And and basically, the fishery here is not very good. U.S. or state fish and wildlife guys, the WDFW, we call them, stock this lake with a trout that has a parasite. And so the trout never get over about 10, 11 inches, and then they expire. It shortens their size and their life. So the guys who like to fish here are using electric trolling motors with small boats. And they, I think they like more the fact that it's relatively, there's a lot of solitude. There's not a lot of people there. It's relatively unimpacted at this point. The DNR has reclassified much of this land as a natural resource recovery area, which is sort of de facto wilderness. They take out the roads.
What's this?
That is a log boom. That's a synthetic log boom. The old one used to actually be logs, but it keeps all the wood that comes out of this system from going into their intake. They go in every year and they collect up all the wood that gathers around here and then haul it out.
And what's this thing right here?
That thing is called the Morning Glory. And that basically is the maximum spill elevation of Spada Reservoir, 1,450 feet. So to give you an example, they've only spilled it, I think, three times in the history of the project. PUD doesn't like water going down the river without going through turbines. So,
so this would go through the Salton River?
Go straight out the bottom of the dam, basically.
Oh.
In 1996 was the last big one.
It's like the standpipe in the back of the toilet. If it gets too full, it goes
exactly. Very similar concept.
And what's this thing right here?
And that is the actual intake structure to the power tunnel. And you can't see it, but on the face of this structure, there are some big sliding gates. They're 20 feet high each. There's four levels. And they have the ability to move the gates up and down into intake water, any of the, from 1450 all the way down to, was it 1380?
Wow. Is this gentleman regulating any of that from that?
No, we don't operate the power.
We don't operate that.
This is PUG's part of the deal.
What's this?
Oh, that's the access to the what's called the Howell Bunger valve. There's a valve at the very bottom of the reservoir and the base of the dam.
Yeah.
So that column actually allows them to go down and access the valve for maintenance. And via that valve is how they release this. I talked about, you know, they release a small amount of water, 20 cubic feet per second, to keep water in the upper river. That's where it's coming from. That's going to be modified to intake at various levels. In fact, they just did that work this fall.
20 cubic feet per second isn't very much, is it?
Well, it's a pretty good-sized little river. I've swum it in the summer, and it's plenty of water in it.
It's moving along.
100 cubic feet per second is more like what the kayakers are interested in, and they'd really like to see 300 because then it gets really crazy. It becomes a this is really a steep canyon in here. This stuff is, I mean, you can't really walk out of here just any old place. There's cliffs and very narrow profile to the.
So if you were going to go swimming here, how would you access it?
Well, you could come in from here
and
walk down.
You walk in. There's no roads up here?
No, not right into the canyon. There's a road that comes, I don't know if you can see it, right here. It dead ends out here, and then you can walk down. There's a number of old mining claims down on the river. So there are still guys that are actively panning, and they have, you know, private holdings along the in this kind of upper reach below the dam and the, above the diversion for the city.
Let's say you were back in the pioneer days, and you're taking a drink out of either one of those dams. What's your chances of getting sick?
About this. No, considerably less because it's pristine. It's not none, though.
Cryptosporidium?
Well, crypto is the newest.
Is that new?
Well,
where did it come from?
You have to go back and talk about how did we come to have a filter plant.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1986, Congress reauthorized the first of the Safe Drinking Water Acts. So the Safe Drinking Water Act basically mandated that EPA formulate regulations for the protection of drinking water and to begin a more stringent standard-setting process. And they didn't really leave EPA a lot of room about numbers. They said these will be the numbers. The original Safe Drinking Water Act it actually set standards. So one of the new rules that came out of the 86 amendments was the surface water treatment rule. And so it basically was focused on Giardia, which came into the fore long before Cryptosporidium. But it's an intestinal parasite, has some pretty severe implications for people who have immune system compromised.
But it's not native to this area?
It's always been here, but probably not in the concentrations you find it today. You know, there's no such thing as wilderness anymore. And that's why they sell all those water filters at REI, because you can't go to, I don't know, pick one in the Alpine Lakes wilderness that you like to hike to. You know, there's been hundreds of people there, and they all bury their waste. Mm-hmm. So in addition to the fecal load that you might see from the native animals, you now have the fecal load from the human animals. And human waste is always a little more risky, although certain animals can carry it as well. And, of course, the most dangerous of the animals are the ones we grow to eat. So horses, cattle, pigs also mm-hmm. are carriers of human-infected versions of all of those. They think that Giardia and Cryptosporidium have always been around, and they think that there are certain species of them that, like for the ones that live in water rats, for example, they're not infected to human beings, or at least not often. But the ones that come from cattle and from people, they know for sure because they've been implicated in a couple of big outbreaks.
Okay. On this map, show me where there's cattle.
Nowhere.
Nowhere.
It's a very well-protected watershed. The fact that it's a natural resource recovery area, that we don't have road access, that we have limitations on human use, your risks are very low.
No wild pigs?
Not that we know of. You have the usual complement of deer, bear, various bird species like pileated woodpeckers and jays and that sort of thing. And then you have all the, you know, rodent mammals, marmots, beavers.
I used to do a lot of backpacking in the 70s and early 80s, and never once did I filter it.
We carried a cup on your belt, you know,
yeah,
anywhere you
right.
went.
That's exactly what you did.
Now you look at it and go, that was a horse crossing.
What are the steps now that we
I'll go back to the plan again. Yeah. Sorry, we got sidetracked. Yeah. So we take the raw water from the lake. We add a little bit of chlorine here, mm-hmm. the first step, to both oxidize iron and manganese and to make sure that we've disinfected well enough that we're not growing slime to the rest of the upper end of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Then we add the coagulants, alum, and the cationic polymers. Those clump all the fine particulates in the water up. And then this particle clumping process takes a while. So this is basically a series of basins that we call flocculation basins. And flocculation is this process of sort of slow mixing. It has a tapered mixing process. There's paddles moving faster at this end, slower here, and none here. It's kind of a three-cell basin. But the whole goal of flocculation is to let these particles all bounce around, bump into each other, and stick together.
Does it drop to the bottom then? After
no, they don't. Oh. And our goal here is to make, unlike a conventional treatment plant, which would have a big sedimentation basin between here and the filters, mm-hmm. we go straight to the filters. So we're building what we call pinpoint flocks. They're relatively small. It doesn't look like snowflakes. It looks like the tiny point of a pencil.
Mm-hmm.
So the pinpoint flock, though, is big enough to get caught in a filter. And so when the water leaves this flock basin, it gets another dose, a very small dose, of a non-ionic filter aid polymer. And the purpose of that polymer is to actually make the grains of the filter stickier.
Mm.
And what you end up with then is water flowing onto deep bed filters, and you have kind of an example there in small scale, but it's a bed of the column on the right. It's 1.3 millimeter diameter anthracite coal sand on a bed of gravel. The water flows in the top. The particles, as they and the water flow down through, they bang into the grains of the filter and they get stuck.
Yeah.
And what you come out with on the other side is clarified water that drains out from under the bottom and then is collected into a pipe. So we have eight big filters. These are 1,530 square feet each. They're in that building that looks like it's connected to this one. Water passing out of the bottom of the filters goes to a flow distribution box where we add fluoride soda ash, which is essentially to raise the pH and alkalinity to a less corrosive state. And then we add a final dose of disinfectant chlorine, and then the water gets routed under normal operation, split into two reservoirs. The original reservoir is about 5.2 million gallons. This one's about 6 3/4. It was completed in late in 2008.
Are they underground?
The one of them's buried. The other one's sort of half above ground.
They're covered?
They're both covered, yes. That's a requirement. Part of the surface water treatment rule is you don't have uncovered reservoirs once you've treated the water.
Where do you get the fluoride from?
We purchase it from various companies. They have a bidding process every year. So each year the companies bid. We have a set of specifications. They have to meet the specs.
Where do they get it?
I'm told there's currently two sites, one in Montana and one down in Louisiana, I believe, where they mine the mineral that they extract the fluoride out of.
Phosphate fertilizer industry?
That filter
it's a phosphate mineral, yes.
Coal, filter coal there. Do you have to dig it out every once in a while and replace it?
Part of this filtration process is eventually the filter has a fixed capacity for particles, so it loads up. We have a way to measure when it starts to plug up. Once it plugs up, we basically take treated water from the clear well and a big pump, and we reverse the flow of water through the filter, and we basically pump all the solids, wash them out, and those go down a waistline to that big pond you saw.
Oh, that's how you do it.
So we call it the backwash water pond or wash water pond. And the water that goes from filter backwash, once it's in the pond, we settle those solids out, and then we decant or repump that water, and it goes back up to Lake Chaplain.
Oh.
And we also have the capability to actually put that water back into the intake. Typically, our backwash water is about 1.5% of our total flow. So of the water we produce, we're going to use 1-2% for cleaning filters. Typical filter run is about 48 hours before it plugs up.
How often do you get a fluoride delivered?
I don't know. John?
About every couple of weeks.
2-3 weeks. Depends on season, obviously. More in the summer and less in the winter.
Now, I've seen this news clip where this fluoride truck spilled fluoride onto the cement. Somehow some accident happened, and it was burning a hole in the cement.
Yeah, 23% acid.
And,
have you ever had a spill here?
No.
Is some of that acid hydrofluoric acid?
No. The only place in, we can talk a little bit about the fluoride building, which is right here. So fluoride storage is here. Sodium hypochlorite storage is over here. That's that big building right there. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the chemicals, alum and polymer, are stored in a structure attached to this building. And soda ash is stored directly on the end of the building. So soda ash comes in as a fine white powder, 70,000-pound loads. Alum comes in 5,000-gallon truckloads, similar to how fluoride would do. It's a big tanker truck. Polymer, we generally take, I think, about 1,000 gallons at a whack. And we have alum stored in one of two tanks here, and polymer stored here, soda ash in big bins here. There's a total of four, potentially. Fluoride comes in 5,000-gallon loads. As a liquid, it's pumped into one or the other of a 6,000-gallon storage tank. And then hypo, we have a series of tanks, also 5,000 gallons at a whack.
Do you know what's inside the trucks that could stand the fluoride so it doesn't eat its way?
They use a type of rubber lining.
It's not Teflon?
No, not that I know of.
What's lining your tanks? Do you put it in at full strength?
These are cross-linked polyethylene tanks, so it's a plastic. Cross-linked polyethylene is more resistant to storage of acid materials. Similar material here with a high pH, sort of the opposite pH, but similar problems with storage of liquid bleach. This is actually the more dangerous material, hypo.
I noticed that the soda ash is over there on the left, and the fluoride injection is over here. Do they get injected at the same time?
Yes.
And how does the soda ash get over there where the fluoride is?
Well, soda ash starts out as a fine white powder, right? And you'll see this when we'll go down and look at a feeder. Mm-hmm. But basically, we have a screw feeder, it's called. It's a volumetric screw. So it's metering the powder into a water tank with a mixer. Mm-hmm. And then once we've mixed up the solution, and of course the solution strength would vary because the speed of the feeder is based to how much water you're pulling into the plant. So we have a meter. And most of our chemical feeds are automatically controlled based on flow. So if you make a flow change, they'll all automatically adjust based on where you had them set. But so we have a soda ash solution that is then pumped, and we have a series of chemical feed conduits to several places depending on the chemical. For example, chlorine we can feed at almost every point. Soda ash you can feed to here and also to here.
So can soda ash go in before filtration?
No.
Okay, after filtration. So there's some kind of line that goes from here over to where?
Yes, it's a solution line, as is the same thing with the bleach solution. It comes down. Mm-hmm. This now, plant, about 50% of it you can't see. It's buried in the ground as pipe.
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous overlay of conduits of electricity, chemical solutions, water.
Now there's two. Excuse me.
What's lining? There must be a pipe between the fluoride and here.
Yes.
What's lining that pipe?
That's composed of chlorinated polyvinyl chloride pipe, CPVC.
So is the, since the acidity level of that fluoride you said was 23%?
Yes.
So, it's a weak acid. I probably would have flunked chemistry if I had ever taken it in any college, but I didn't, so bear with me. If you put that corrosive of a material, even you're using rubber and plastics, and of course I go to great lengths to avoid plastics like BPA, etc. How is it that is not going to be pulling the plastics and rubber? I mean, isn't there some leakage of the plastics and rubber out of the...
I can't answer that. I don't know. I can tell you that we test for a vault organic carbon and most of the synthetics after all of this is done, and we don't find any.
How long does this pipe last?
Including the plasticizers.
Does this pipe last a long time that runs the fluoride straight into here?
Well, they're about to rebuild the system for the first time since we built it, so it's lasted 20 years, and that's pretty typical for PVC chemical. You know, like the alum and polymer feed lines here we just replaced, and they all were at that 25-year-old. They get brittle.
Up here, from here and in this pipeline, is this full strength like it comes in from the truck? Or
yes.
Is there an additional solution right
you have there? Storage tanks, and then they...
That's full strength stuff from the
yes,
truck.
Yes, but then they put the feed chemical into a smaller tank, and then it has a metering pump. So a metering pump is, again, flow-paced.
Right.
And so the metering pump is actually pumping out a very small amount via a much smaller line. There's no...
But it's still full strength.
Yes.
The dilution is here.
Yes. And this structure is actually designed to mix all three of those chemicals, soda ash, fluoride, and chlorine.
You've never had a mistake?
A mistake?
Yeah. You've never had an error?
Overfeed? Or
no.
This gets overfed here?
No, this system's actually designed, it has an online analyzer, so it's continuously analyzing fluoride concentration.
So it's all computerized?
And it's designed to cut out. So you can't. It shuts down before it can get...
I'm not asking to be rude. I'm asking because
no.
I know there have been mistakes in some systems.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure,
well, there's a case in Alaska that's a beauty. Of course, it's a small system.
Now, once it goes to the finished water pump station and getting ready to be sent down to Everett or wherever...
Right, so that's the next piece.
At that point, is that where you analyze the water before it goes, as it goes down to the city, to see what the content is?
Well, after we put the chemicals in here, then they go into the clear wells. And the clear wells really do two things. One, they provide time for mixing.
Yeah.
And they also provide contact time. They're actually divided inside, so you have water flowing back and forth through here or around this one. And so that's mainly aimed at chlorine contact because the other chemicals mix pretty fast.
Mm.
They're basically mixed by the time they leave here. So when the water comes out of the clear well, we test it. And we test it all along here, but...
But that's the last part where you test right there.
And this would be considered, for many of the contaminants we would be required to test for, is the so-called compliance point. We have to meet the standards of all of those different rules at this point. Mm-hmm. So,
and is it an ongoing test, or is it taken samples at different times?
Depends on the parameter. For example, chlorine and fluoride are analyzed continuously, 24/7.
Oh, it is.
pH is also monitored in this clear well, these two clear wells, continuously. But on the other hand, when you look at things, and in some cases we like turbidity also. But when you get into some of the more exotic, I call them, you know, when you start talking about, I don't know, let's talk about phthalates, plasticizers. So we don't have a source of phthalates in our source water, and we don't really have a source of them in this system, but we're still required to test for them. We test for those once a year.
My apologies, too, just as, as a quick point of reference, if anyone needs to use a restroom, there's one.
Oh,
there's
I forgot to mention.
The women's room just down the hall.
Oh, okay. Left.
Great.
Can you
set
before we move out?
Sure.
Now, there's a south line that's just one pipe, and then the north lines
yes.
that go to Everett.
So,
does this bypass line go to the south line?
This is the number 5 line, which is the southern transmission corridor. That flows by gravity straight out of the reservoir.
And that's the one that only has chlorine treated, right?
No, it has everything.
Oh, that one has everything.
And then we have the
but
finished water.
It doesn't
pump.
Show up on this schematic.
Industrial water doesn't show here at all.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
And then the finished water pump station is designed to pump water up the shore of Lake Chaplin. So from here up to here.
Uh-huh.
And then up where the old diversion, the 1929 diversion from the lake was originally constructed, that has now been sealed off from the lake. And the water flows through the old diversion tunnel and then connects on the other side of the hill to the two transmission lines that carry treated water all the way to town and to everybody in between.
Hmm.
And parallel to that system up there is the industrial water intake and a separate tunnel, a separate intake, and a separate pipeline. And, of course, it has a separate reservoir down here. And the connections, interconnections from the old days have all been removed.
But that industrial one there, if someone were to drink that water, it would be perfectly safe with them.
You wouldn't meet the standards. You wouldn't be able to supply it to anyone. It doesn't meet the Safe Drinking Water Act requirements.
Oh, it doesn't. Oh, okay.
It's untreated surface water,
oh.
essentially.
Oh, I see.
With not enough chlorine to even begin.
Oh, okay.
And the problem with some of these pathogens, the reason you have to have a double barrier is essentially the way they put it, but cryptosporidium is resistant to chlorine. You can put the cyst phase of crypto, the part that goes excreted out into the environment from whatever host
mm-hmm.
organism
yeah,
has the
yeah,
disease,
yeah.
into 50 parts per million of chlorine, which is 50 times what we supply, and it doesn't kill it in days. And so you have to have either physical removal, in this case filtration, or you have to use disinfectant systems that will kill it, so UV light or ozone, which is a very strong oxidant. And the problem with UV and ozone is you can use them as a pre-disinfection treatment,
mm-hmm.
like Seattle does, but in order to carry a disinfectant residual out in your system, you've got to use either chlorine or chloramines. We're not interested in chloramines, so we use chlorine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all required by law.
So you avoid the chloramines because?
Chloramines are basically chlorine in combination with ammonia.
And they don't evaporate out.
So they're very persistent. The problem with them is, there's a couple of them. One is there's a very delicate balance in the between the amount of ammonia and the amount of chlorine. If you go too far one way or the other, you either lose your disinfectant or you start to aminate your system and you get, one, all kinds of horrible chlorinous tastes and odors, but also starts to produce nitrogenous waste out in the distribution. So there's been a lot of research lately about nitrosamines. And it appears to us, based on what we're reading currently, that chloraminated systems are at much higher risk for nitrosamine contamination. Low dose where they're dangerous. So